Hello and welcome to True Crime Medieval, 1,000 Years of People Behaving Badly. I'm Anne Brannan, and I'm your host in Albuquerque.
And I'm Michelle Butler in Tuscaloosa.
And today we are going to talk about a really stupid bad crime that was just stupid and bad and just dumb. So that's what we're going to talk about, and it was awful. We're going to Viterbo, Italy, in 1271, where Henry de Almaine was murdered by Guy and Simon de Montfort, Simon de Montfort the Younger, who were his cousins, the sons of Simon de Montfort, in retaliation for their father having been killed and mutilated at the Battle of Evesham, a battle that Henry hadn't been at. What the hell? Here's our background. That battle had been in the Second Barons War. The First Barons War lasted from 1215 to 1217. And in it, some barons rebelled against King John at that time because he wasn't abiding by what he had said he would abide by in the Magna Carta, which had been signed in 1215. The signing of the Magna Carta had come after rebellions against John's taxes, which had been grievous on account of John had been busy trying to get the Angevin lands back from King Philip II of France, and he kept losing, and so then he needed more money because he had to pay things like ransoms and fees and I'm sorry money, that kind of thing that you have to pay after war if you don't win it. And also, John was just horrible. I mean, we often say this, that he wasn't a good king, he wasn't a good man, that's just how it was. And one of the things he believed with that was that kings were above the law, which is one of the reasons Magna Carta got invented at all. It was like, no, you also have to like abide by some principles. So that was the First Barons War. And John died of dysentery in 1216. The First Barons War wasn't over yet. And his 9-year-old son, who was Henry, became king. But really, of course, his regent was running things, and that was William Marshall, who shows up in our podcast quite often. William Marshall, here he is, Michelle, back again.
Yay!
And very quickly, a revived Magna Carta was reissued and signed. And so that reinforced some of the baronial support for the English monarchy. That was important because the French, led by Philip's son Louis, had been being defeated on English territory, including the Battle of Sandwich, where Eustace, the pirate monk, was killed. We have a podcast about Eustace, the pirate monk. And so the First Barons' War ended in 1217. Got a new Magna Carta, got the French off English territory, although the English aren't completely off the French territory, but there you are. And France agreed that France was not the ruler of England. And the barons said they were sorry. And the French told the Scots and the Welsh that they shouldn't fight the English anymore. Like, that does any good. Oh, the French say that we shouldn't go over the border and whack the English. No, that's what the French said. Because, you know, they'd been using them as allies. And William Marshall saved the royal day. And so that's great. So that's the First Barons' War, where the barons rebelled against John. The Second Barons' War, which is the one which we're more concerned with, was when the barons fought his son. This would be King Henry III, who had been 9 during the first one, but now was all grown up, and whose regent has done so well in bringing the First Barons' War to a close. So Henry grew up, and the reasons for the Second Barons' War were much the same as there had been. There was hard taxing, and the barons also didn't like Henry. And also there was a famine, and so that didn't make things any better. And so this war lasted 1264 to 1267. So neither one of them are really long wars. They're not like the Cousins' War, which most people call the War of the Roses. They're not like the Cousins' War, which really went on for a long, long time, long time, we several generations. This was just like, wah, 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 and then, you know, you sign something. The barons were led in the Second Barons' War by Simon de Montfort, Simon de Montfort, senior, not junior, who was going to be misbehaving later. Simon de Montfort wanted the king to rule with the barons, with a council of the barons, rather than just a few guys that the king liked, which had really been, you know, who are the counselors? Oh, some guys I picked who are my best buddies. Simon de Montfort wanted a representative council. And he'd been in France. In fact, he was born in France. He had, when young, been a leader of the Albigensian Crusade. We have a podcast on that, too, where the French slaughtered the Cathars of the Occitan because they were the wrong sort of Christians. And he gave up his lands in France, and he kept his lands in England. And by 1236, he was one of Henry III's favorites, and he became the Earl of Leicester. In 1238, he married the king's sister, Eleanor, who was the widow of William Marshall. Da-da-da! William Marshall back in. They're all related. They're all related. Everybody's married to everybody's family. Anyway, so this is the widow of William Marshall. She was 16 when William Marshall died, and she swore a vow of chastity. She was never going to marry again. She broke this vow a year later when she married Simon de Montfort. The archbishop condemned the marriage, and the barons were all pissed off because Simon wasn't of high rank, and he was French, and, you know, the princess of England had married him, and this was bad. And Richard of Cornwall, who was Eleanor and Henry's brother, rebelled and had to be bought off. So there wasn't a really good reaction to this wedding. But Simon and Eleanor named their first son Henry, and Henry named Simon as one of the godfathers when Prince Edward was born. And so things were okay for a little while. They were really great. It was a little while. It was a little while, and then they fell apart. Because Simon owed one of Eleanor's uncles some money, and he named Henry, King Henry, as his security. And so the king flipped right out and said some very bad things, and also said that he was going to imprison Simon in the Tower. And so Simon and Eleanor went to France. And then Simon went on crusade. I forgot to mention that during his time in England, he had also thrown the Jews out of Lincoln. He was that sort of person. At any rate, he went on crusade. These things are related. People who are not Christians and the right sort of Christian, that kind of, you know, so that's the kind of guy he was. He didn't fight on this crusade. And then he came back and he helped Henry fight King Louis IX, who was the Louis who had been in England, the son of Philip. And now he was king because Philip died, as humans do, really, always, eventually. And he had inherited the throne. But that actually lessened any admiration that he had for Henry, who was really a very dreadful military leader. And then he worked for Henry as the administrator for Aquitaine. Only there were complaints. And so he got investigated for oppressing people in Aquitaine. And he was acquitted, but Henry was still suspicious. And he thought he'd maybe misused the funds. And so Simon went back to France. But he really wanted to reconcile with Henry. God love him. And he did. But really, it was just too contentious. It was too contentious. And they had very different ideas about how the world should be run. There were a couple of parliaments. And at the second, Simon was going to be one of the king's official counselors. But the king, who had earlier agreed to the council, changed his mind. So Simon left again. And then he came back in 1263 with other barons who had invited him back, because he actually was a good military leader, a very good military leader, unlike Henry, who was not so great. Some barons invited him back, and Simon led a rebellion against the king. That's just where we are at this point. And the rebellion was involved in massacring Jews, who were an integral part of the royalty money-making and taxation process. And Simon's sons, Simon and Henry, were leaders in the massacres, along with Robert Ferrers and John Fitzjohn and Gilbert de Clare. Massacres in Worcester and London and Winchester and Canterbury and Derby and Lincoln and Northampton. They murdered the humans and they took their money and possessions and they burnt any records of debts there, so there were no debts to the Jews. And at that point, the king let Simon de Montfort be the head of the council. But Henry's son, who was the future Edward I. Michelle and I talk a lot about Edward I because we consider him to be an incredibly good king, but we don't like stuff he does. Like, it's really hard to admire the greatness of a king who built castles all over Wales and stole the Stone of Scone. But this is the future Edward I. Henry's not dead yet. He's going to be one of the strongest and most intelligent and scary of the English kings. He got a bunch of the barons onto the royal side with bribes of money and offices. So he was very canny in that way. And so there's a civil war. And that's the beginning of the Second Barons' War in 1264. The Royalists trapped the rebel barons in London, but Simon de Montfort marched out and won the Battle of Lewes. King Henry, at that point, King Henry, Prince Edward, and Richard of Cornwall were all captured, and de Montfort canceled all the debts that the Christians owed to the Jews in England. And he set up a government wherein the king would govern, but with the approval of the council, and he would consult with Parliament. There had been elected parliaments before in England, but de Montfort, besides sending orders to the counties of England and the chartered towns, the chartered boroughs, to elect two representatives, so that's where the representatives were coming from, included not just nobles, but regular citizens. So that's the first of the elected parliaments. It's Simon de Montfort's parliament that includes the commoners. And that structure of parliament is what is still existing in England. However, Prince Edward escaped because he was Prince Edward. I forget what I think he bribed one of the guards, but he got out. And the Anglo-Norman marcher lords in Wales favored him. Gilbert declared defected because he got jealous and resentful of Simon's power and success. And Edward captured more of Simon's followers. And then what he did, and this is one of those brilliant military moves that's just god-awful, you know, in terms of, is this moral? No. Is it brilliant? Yes, it is. He fooled Simon, who was, as I've said, also a very really good military leader, by marching with the de Montfort banners that he had captured, thereby maneuvering him into having to fight in desperate conditions. Simon's forces were fighting uphill against a much larger crew, and he would never have done that except that he had been maneuvered into it. His son Henry was killed, and at that point Simon said, it's time to die. And Edward had sent a death squad to track down Simon de Montfort in the battle and make sure he was dead. And they found him, and he was killed by being stabbed in the neck. It was Roger Mortimer stabbed him in the neck with a lance. And then the royalists went berserk. They cut off his head and testicles, and they put his testicles on either side of his nose. And Roger Mortimer sent that head to his wife, Maud, as a gift. Had you heard that, Michelle?
I did know that they had, yeah.
And that it had been sent as a gift?
Yeah, I did know that, but...
Because who is Maud that he would think that this is a good gift? We just had Valentine's Day over here, and I don't think anybody got this kind of thing as a gift, really. I mean, it's mostly chocolate and flowers, right? It's like, here's a gift, honey. Somebody's decomposing head with their genitals tacked on it. I don't think that's a good present.
You know, that actually is, there's a difference, right, between going into battle, because it is, there's two things that have happened. Having tossed out the code of chivalry enough to say, we need to end this. If you find him, kill him. Edward's the one who gave that order. I think that in some ways, the de Montfort boys could have accepted that because they would have done the same thing.
That people die in battle, and you do your battle the best you can, and you don't go around hunting down people who are in the battle later because you already had the battle.
In general, the nobles don't kill each other; they capture each other and they ransom each other.
Yes, and so something has really changed here. That there was Edward sent a death squad. Mm-hmm.
But we've seen that before. That's what William the Conqueror did at Hastings.
Yes, he did. He was very bad.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a codal chivalry, unless it really matters, in which case send a pack of six guys to hunt your dude down and kill him. Make sure he doesn't walk off the field, because that's how you win. But the mutilation, there's no justification.
There's really no reason. It does make sense. If you're up against Simon de Montfort, you want him off the table, because you notice in this story that he kept leaving and coming back and leaving and coming back. I mean, there's no way to deal. There's no way to get Simon de Montfort to stop except by stopping him. That's just how that is. So fair enough. Okay. It was very, very, it was a trick using those banners. And I think it's just so wrong. It was so wrong to use the banners.
Well, and because of that, Edward has to do reputation management when he becomes king.
Killing Simon alone, that would have not had to, he wouldn't have had to make that be okay.
Yeah, he gets called a leopard.
Yeah, that's not good.
Yeah, yeah. That he should be a lion, but he's a leopard. And so he has to do rebranding to salvage his reputation, because otherwise nobody would go into any agreements with him. He's not trustworthy.
On the subject of Simon de Montfort's head and the gift to Maud, Roger Mortimer is a marcher lord. Maud is Maud de Braise. She's the daughter of William de Braise.
God almighty.
Her mother is one of the daughters of William Marshall. That really was a very bloody family. And yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So as I say, this is a very, very bad thing to send your wife as a present, unless maybe she's Maud de Braise. I guess that would be okay. There's nothing about Maud saying, "Oh my God, what the hell have you done? Why did you send this to me? I wanted chocolates." We don't have that, actually, and that's not written down any place. And so maybe Maud went, "Oh yay, look at this! What are you doing with it then? Oh, like, would you put this on? Would you put this over the castle walls on a pike? Because you know you can't leave it. You can't leave it in the hall. You got to do something with it." At any rate, I'm fascinated by that gift, but we can move on.
The Normans.
So besides doing that, they also cut de Montfort's hands and feet off and sent them to various places. And then they buried the rest of him in church. But the commoners later would keep visiting the grave and thinking of it as holy ground. So Henry is going to later have him dug up and reburied in some secret places. And after the battle, the soldiers who had fled were found dead in a nearby village. So that was the end of the Second Barons' War. That's all over. So that's the background to the crime of today. The crime of today wasn't even what they did to Simon de Montfort. That's just, you know, we're moving on from that. That's just a thing that happened. The Battle of Evesham, this battle had been in 1265, and our crime takes place in 1271. Okay. Our dead person. Henry of Almain was the son of Richard of Cornwall, this brother of Henry's and Eleanor's, who was the elected king of Germany. So that's how Henry got his name. It's from Alemannia. Alemannia, Almain, fair enough. And we remember that Richard's the son of King John. And Henry's mother was Isabel Marshall, who was the daughter of William Marshall. Everybody's related, not just by being related to the Plantagenets, but everybody's related to William Marshall for sure.
Yeah, he had a ton of kids and he married them off well, particularly the daughters.
He's the nephew of Henry III. He's also the nephew of Simon de Montfort because, you remember, Simon was married to Eleanor, who's also the daughter of King John and the sister of King Henry and Richard of Cornwall. You remember that part. So he was, not surprisingly, very divided in loyalty at the beginning of the Second Barons' War. And he told Simon de Montfort that he would not take up arms against either one of them. But he ended up having to do something. And so he had to decide. So he went with the royalist. And he was captured along with the other hostages, the king and his cousin Prince Edward, and they were all captured at the Battle of Loos. And then he was released in 1268. So that was great. So he went on crusade. But he got sent back because Edward, who was also on crusade at that point with him, wanted him to go and take care of some problems that had come up in Gascony. And so instead of sailing, Henry took the land route and from Sicily up on through Italy. And that's why he was in Viterbo on the 12th of May in 1271. Guy de Montfort and his brother, Simon de Montfort Jr., had been roaming around Europe since 1266 when Guy, who had been captured at the Battle of Evesham, escaped. And Simon Jr., who had missed the battle because he got there too late to help his dad, whom he saw up on a pike, he had tried a little rebellion, which didn't go any place, and he had surrendered, and then he escaped. And so they got together, and they were roaming around Europe, and they eventually ended up in Italy, where they heard that their cousin was in Viterbo, and they found him at Mass at the church of St. Sylvester, and they murdered him while he clutched the altar, begging for mercy. And Guy said, "You had no mercy for my father and brothers," but Henry hadn't even been at the Battle of Evesham. Oh, and by the way, did anybody see this? Yes. Because the cardinals were there. They were having a papal election. And so were the kings of France and Sicily. Yeah. So people saw this. It wasn't done in secret. The brothers were both excommunicated. And King Henry was really pissed off. And the Pope was really pissed off. And Edward let the Pope know that Henry was on a peace mission. He hadn't been at Evesham. Ugh, they just killed him because he was associated with the people that had done bad things. Simon died that same year, we are told, cursed by God, a murderer and a fugitive. So I don't know what he died of, but he had been cursed by God. So maybe he died of that. A guy went to fight for Charles of Anjou, which he had done before, but he got captured in 1287, fighting the Aragonese at the Battle of the Counts in 1287, and he died in prison. So that's what happened to them. Henry's body was taken to Gloucestershire and buried at Hales Abbey, but his heart was put into a golden shrine and is buried in Westminster Abbey next to the shrine of Edward the Confessor. And so that was our crime. It's a little bitty crime in the middle of a great big story. And Michelle, you got lots of stuff, didn't you? Because obviously this is going to be something that catches the imagination.
Well, yeah, it really was a scandal. Killing somebody in a church, you know, is pretty scandalous.
We want to do a whole episode on this, by the way, on killing people in churches and claiming sanctuary.
Yeah, it's pretty scandalous. And a measure of how scandalous it is that Dante references this. Inferno is completed by 1314. It's set in 1300. So he puts Guy, I think it's Guy, in hell. He's in a river of boiling blood. But the way he refers to it, it's not, I actually had to read it twice to find it, because he doesn't ever say Guy de Montfort. He doesn't ever say Henry de Almaine. It's this really bleak reference. He says, he cleft asunder in God's bosom the heart that still upon the Thames is honored.
Oh.
And that tells, that deeply oblique reference tells me that this was hot news. And it stayed hot for a long time.
Everybody would have known who this was.
Everybody knew what that meant.
Oh, it's a terrible crime. They murdered their cousin, who hadn't even done the thing that they murdered him for, and they murdered him in the church at mass during a papal election.
When the priest tried to step between them, they killed him too.
Oh, I didn't know that part. Thank you.
Oh my God. Yeah, it's just so dreadful. It's terrible.
Would Simon de Montfort himself have ever done that? Uh-uh. No, he has these really just, these are inferior children, I tell you.
Some sources that I found said that Henry was clutching to the altar and they chopped off three of his fingers to drag him out. So it's bad.
Yeah, Henry hadn't wanted, he had been in one of the battles and he hadn't ever wanted to fight at all. And it wasn't because it wasn't a political thing for him. It was, these are my uncles. These are my uncles. So it was very bad of his cousins to kill him.
His dad kind of likes this approach too. With the stay down here in Cornwall and mind our own business. This is not the first time we've run across Dante sticking one of our murderers in hell.
Oh no, we started with Dante, but he wasn't in hell. Con Grande della Scala.
Oh yes.
Yeah, that's why we did it, was because it was Dante and you wanted Dante.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There was another one though, Uberto, who is also in hell. This amuses me greatly because you run across discussions of Dante and it's all about this elevated poetry and it's thinking big thoughts, but yeah, okay. But it's also settling medieval scores and spilling the tea about contemporary.
Yes, because he put somebody into hell who wasn't dead yet, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's a lost play that we know existed from 1592. We know it existed because it's discussed by Henslow in inaccurately named Henslow's diary. It's not a diary. It's business records of what they were doing. It's actually really important. It's one of the ways we know about the economics of early modern theater.
That was one of the ways that they used the word diary.
So maybe that's what's going on.
We think of it as a journal, but journal meant journal, and that meant daily accounts.
So that's what's going on then, is that the word has shifted its meaning. Henslow's son-in-law was Edward Allen, the actor. And between the two of them, they have thousands of pages of manuscripts that have this stuff in it. that ends. There's also a couple of other useful things among that. It's one of them is the sole surviving actor's part from a play from the period, from Orlando Furioso. That's part of this archive. Here's a quote from the Henslow Allen Digitization Project.org, which is henslow-allen.org.uk. As a group, these manuscripts comprise the largest and most important single extant archive of material on the professional theater and dramatic performance in early modern England. So it's a really important collection.
And it's digitized. We can go and look at it?
Yes.
Oh, you'll give us the link.
Yep. It's important stuff. And Allen is the founder of Dulwich College in London, which is actually a K through 12 school. And it was in their archive that this was held for a very long time.
When did they find it?
It was found in the 19th century. This is the manuscript that has suffered some trials and tribulations. Edward Malone took it home for a while. Edward Malone, he's a great scholar. The Malone Society is named for him. But, you know, the 19th century just didn't have developed scholarly concepts, I guess, as much as now, because he took souvenirs from this manuscript.
It's kind of like the whole feeling of imperialism and colonization kind of like spilled over into medieval manuscripts. It's the same way that you can like take statues out of Egypt and bring them on over and just stick them in the museum. You can take a manuscript and cut pieces out you like. I mean, hello, because you're English. You know what I mean?
There were famous people, you know, people whose signatures he really wanted were in there, and he just kind of snipped them out and kept them.
Yeah, totally entitled. Nowadays, if he showed up, we could write a little thing and send it into Reddit, you know, entitled people. Yep.
Oh, yes. Before I move off into 19th century scholars mistreating early modern records, the actual play was called Harry of Cornwall. Yeah, I'm so traumatized by it.
I'm sorry, Michelle, that you had to read about manuscripts being hurt.
Oh, my Lord.
At least no tea sandwiches were being used as bookmarks. That was, I remember, an issue in one of our earlier podcasts.
It was performed by Lord Strange's men at the Rose Playhouse on 1592, and it did really well. It received 32 shillings.
Ooh, nice.
Yes. That we have there's a different website called Henslow as a blog that takes an entry per day and puts it out there. And so this day's entry is what we get told about it is Harry of Cornwall provided Henslow with his most impressive box office so far. It made more than twice as much as Sir John Mandeville did yesterday. So the play they were talking about the day before. But it's lost. And so we don't, now I'm not quoting.
It was called Henry of Cornwall.
It was called Harry of Cornwall.
Harry of Cornwall rather than Harry of Almaine. Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty, they're pretty sure. No, we don't know for certain, but they're pretty sure it's about Henry getting murdered. And one of the reasons they think that is that another play in the repertoire, it's a Edward I play, and it starts with totally not historically what happened, Simon and Guy getting dragged in front of Edward I to answer for the murder of Henry.
That would have been nice, but it didn't happen.
So they think that these plays were being done in repertoire together.
Well, and also, if you're going to have a play called Harry of Cornwall and it's about Henry of Almaine, really the only thing that's dramatic that you could put on the stage would be the murder. So you'd have to build up to it, like kind of like I did with the Baron's Wars.
Yeah.
That's it. Things that Henry did got murdered at the altar. That's what
this blogger says, that the Italians apparently believed that Henry's heart had been placed in a golden cup on London Bridge, where it still dripped blood into the Thames because Henry had not been avenged.
I think they're right. And it's probably still there. Oh, wait, no, this is London Bridge?
Yes.
Oh, well, that's in Arizona, so it can't do that anymore.
That's connected to Dante, how it's discussed in Dante. Anyway,
well, thank
Henry's heart probably isn't actually in Westminster Abbey anymore, because it was, the heart shrine was placed in with the shrine of Edward the Confessor, but then that shrine was rebuilt in the reign of Mary I. And it appears to have gotten lost in the renovations, as sometimes happens.
The heart would get lost. The gold shrine probably didn't get lost so much as repurposed.
Mm-hmm. It didn't make the leap once things were being put back in.
Oh, well, so it's not there anymore. I didn't know that, and I don't like to know that, because I wanted his heart to still be there in Westminster
According
Abbey.
According to Westminster Abbey, it's not.
If I was Westminster Abbey, I'd be much more liable, if I was going to lie, to say that something was there that wasn't, but you just can't see
it. Well, I mean, maybe if they do a full inventory.
Nobody ever does full inventories. Everybody's always going to do an inventory. Every time, even you do a partial inventory, you always find some stuff. Oh my God, look at that.
The big old forger that I ran across that I'm hoping to have a reason to talk about at some point in more detail is John Payne Collier.
Uh-huh.
Who was notorious.
This sounds like a 19th century name, isn't it?
He is so much. Let me quote this guy. Blog post by Matthew Lyons. John Payne Collier. Three words sure to chill the heart of any scholar working on early modern literary texts. Because Collier was that most interesting of phenomena, a fine scholar who was also a first-class fraud. One of the things he did was borrow. They let him walk out with the manuscript, the unique manuscript of Henslowe's diaries. And then when he published it, he just interpolated stuff that should have been there.
Well, okay, wait. Was some of that stuff the stuff that had been cut out?
No, that was Edward Malone made off with signatures of people he wanted to be able to post into his autograph book like some kind of early modern fanboy.
So Collier just added some stuff?
He added things that he wanted to be there. And I had known about J.W. Walker doing this with the Townley Blaze, wanting to connect them to Wakefield.
Yeah, which you can do if you make some stuff up.
My goodness gracious, this was not as uncommon. And Collier did this a lot, actually.
Well, what was he making up in Henslowe's diaries?
So he's making up additional entries. But he is wild. He pretended at one point to have found a second first folio in which he had written. It was called the Perkins Folio, in which he passed off, now I'm quoting, he passed off his own emendations to Shakespeare as the work of a near contemporary. And there are over 20,000 corrections.
Whoa.
That he added into that. In 2004, a brand new book came out that's the authoritative, exhaustive work. I can't imagine how long it took these people to do this. On him as both a critic and a forger. And it is 1,483 pages long in two volumes. I have ordered a copy because I need to see this, but it hasn't come yet.
Did you buy it or are
no,
you
no, I bought it from a delightful bookstore in, I think, New Hampshire.
So it's like one volume about the criticism and the other volume about the forgeries, or are they just kind of sprinkled together?
He forged so many things. I'll just read this. It's wild. Aside from including deliberate fictions and falsehoods in printed records of archival material, he also introduced forgeries into the archives themselves, faking official documents, adding information to letters and diaries, falsifying registers and inventories, and more. He tampered with at least 57 authentic manuscripts and rare printed material.
Oh, good God.
Oh, wild. And he forged entire ballads, some of which have made their way into anthologies as authentic.
I was going to ask how much impact he's had on scholarship, because surely some of this stuff wasn't caught till later.
And it's so difficult because, you know, you have like, say, 75% of his work is really good scholarship. And then you have this other 25% where he's like, it should have been like this. Or this will make a great paper. Or I'm sure this is true. I just haven't found the evidence, so I'll just fudge it.
This is not a scholarly method.
It's so much worse than somebody like Thomas Middleton, right, who was forging ballads, medieval ballads. We know that all of them, all his stuff is forged. So great. That's so much easier. This is terrible.
because some of it's true. Is there a kind of consensus now that we've been able to sift the chaff from the grain?
Yeah, we've got the big two-volume set that does that work. But I mean, basically, if you have to work with this guy, you have to check everything. And of course, you know, now there have to be new editions of everything you worked on, because you have to go through and check it all. But his edition of Henslowe's diary was the published ones for like 60 years.
Of course.
Until somebody went, wait a second, that's not real.
Were they really having cafe au lais over in Dorset? I don't think so. Did they really put on Angels in America? No, they did not.
So I had to really restrain myself from wandering off down a John Collier rabbit hole. But if that 1500 page book had come, I absolutely would have been reading it before this. The church where Henry was murdered is still there. You can go visit it. There's a plaque commemorating the murder.
Yeah, because the Italians must have been pretty upset.
Yeah, they weren't thrilled. Sharon K. Penman's Welsh Princess Trilogy, the second book in it, is all about Simon de Montfort.
I like that trilogy very
much. The third book is after Simon is dead, but it shows the murder of Henry de Almaine.
Mm-hmm. Eleanor gets real upset.
And there is a brand new, so 2022 book by Carol McGrath called The Damask Rose that is actually about Eleanor of Castile, Edward's queen, but it does mention the murder of Henry. I would have liked to have read Harry of Cornwall, though. I'm sad that that's lost. That would have been really interesting. And it did well. They did it. They did it in London. They earned money. And then they took it on tour when the plague shut down the theaters, and they had the next year when they had to go to Bristol. They took it on tour. So it would have been nice to read it.
I would like to see how it is they built up to the murder, you know, how it is they contextualize it. I would like to have seen that. Oh, well.
I would have liked to have known what they did with it and where the sympathy is in the play were, because sometimes I'm surprised where the sympathies of a piece are. There's so much stuff going on with history plays in the 1590s. It just would have been really interesting to see this one, you know, not the usual suspects of Richard III or the Henrys. It would have been interesting to see.
Yeah.
But alas, nobody bothered to keep it.
Or they did keep it, and then as Byron says, somebody used it to line pie tins.
Well, you know, it's hard with the plays, because if you write them down, then somebody else can do them. And so you're trying to keep your economic advantage by keeping your plays secret. I understand. But it would have been nice.
It's not like if you're in York, we have to write things down because some other people are going to be doing the same thing next year. No, it's what happens when you make theaters professional. Everything changes, doesn't it?
So that's what I have, a play I don't have. Dante telling us that it was a super huge scandal that he could refer to very obliquely half a century later. And everybody was like, yeah, we know that. We remember.
It was really bad.
Oh, it was super bad. And I'm totally fascinated by the image that of what they think is happening, that the shrine's been clamped on to London Bridge and is just sitting there dripping because nobody's avenged.
Yeah, who made this up?
That's a great image.
The heart got put into a golden shrine, so so it's encased in gold. And so that clearly is information that is the foundation of this particular picture that someone has invented. But I really like, who's the first to say this? When did this start? It was in Italy that they were saying this, huh? Nobody said this in England. Because for one thing, you could go to London and notice that it wasn't there, so there was that.
Well, yeah, but, you know, you're not.
Like that
probably
matters.
Not going to do that.
Yeah, so that is interesting. But avenging, what would that have looked like? I mean, just more deaths. They got excommunicated and nobody liked them, and they had sad, short little lives after this. And his death was supposedly some kind of avenging of their dad's death, and it didn't avenge anything. He didn't do it. He wasn't there. He wasn't even nearby.
He's who they could get a hold of. They couldn't get a hold of Edward, who had given the order to kill Simon, although I would be astonished if Edward had given the order to mutilate him.
No, I don't think he did. No, I think they just went berserk.
Edward's a pretty pragmatic person, and I just don't see that.
They couldn't get a hold of Mortimer, who seems to be a big instigator of the hacking things up.
Yeah, he's who they could get a hold of, but I'm starting to think that every war in the Middle Ages is a cousin's war.
Well, it sure as hell is in England.
They're all related.
Well, that is our discussion of the very sad murder of a guy who didn't deserve it at all in 1271. And the next time that you hear from us, we're going to be in Poland in the 13th century, where the High Duke of Poland got murdered kind of ignominiously. And so we're going to be discussing that. This has been True Crime Medieval, where the crimes are just like they are today, only with less technology. We can be found on Spotify and Apple Podcast and all the places where the podcasts are hanging out. And the website is truecrimemedieval.com. True Crime Medieval is just all one word. And you can find the show notes and links to the podcast and transcriptions. And you can leave comments and get a hold of us there. And we'd love to hear from you. And yeah, so yeah, the Middle Ages. Some very badly behaved people today. Bye.
Bye.